Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the show. We are taking an international tour for now, circling around some of the non-American Survivor seasons and Big Brother seasons that we've seen whet our appetite for Survivor over the past few months. And we couldn't let Australian Survivor, or Australian Survivor, as some have taken to calling it, go by without being wrapped up. And so to do that, I decided to invite on the biggest Hayley stan that I know, and that's saying quite a bit, the one and only Matt Gagan. Thanks for joining me.
Oh my God, thank you for having me. I usually don't like puns, but when you involve Hayley, like I have to be in favor for it.
Right. Oh, man. I have been watching the episodes, and all of them, there have been so many, God damn it. I've been watching all the episodes this season with one of the biggest George stans that I know. So maybe we can invite her on here and you can have some kind of debate segment. But for now, this is a pro-Hayley platform, just so everyone here knows what they're getting themselves into.
Yeah, oh man, I can't even imagine being on the other side and being a George stan.
Yeah, I feel like I haven't really seen too much anti-Hayley stuff. I mean, there's a certain group of hardcore George partisans, I guess, who think that he was robbed and the jury was bitter and so on. But I haven't seen too much, even from them, that's been anti-Hayley. I think a lot of people are putting respect on her name, even if they're not happy with the outcome there or they have some doubts about the season as a whole.
Yeah, I agree. George is very polarizing. But I mean, of course, it could just be that I'm in my own little bubble on Twitter. But I don't see anyone, you know, like you said, even the big George supporters, I don't see anyone bashing Hayley. She seems to be getting the respect that that she deserves for the most part.
Yeah, but let's not jump ahead right to the ending here. Let's go as most podcasts should, back to the beginning here to start this off. Because Australian Survivor was the first taste of Survivor that we've had in so long under COVID. And we had at one point Australian Survivor ending, Survivor South Africa ending, and then US Survivor starting all at roughly the same time. So it was almost Survivor overload for a little bit. But this was the first season to bring that back to us in any real capacity. And so I think for a lot of people, there were higher expectations riding on the season than maybe there would be normally. And given how Australian Survivor All-Stars went, I don't know if those expectations were set very high.
Yes. I mean, first of all, as far as I'm concerned, ever since Australian Survivor burst onto the scene in 2016, this has been Survivor proper for me. This has been the Survivor canon. It's this and everything else since then, like the American version, has just been some kind of weird reboot that I watch in the meantime while waiting for the next Australian Survivor season to come out.
Hmm. I think that's maybe where we differ, because I think for a lot of fans who were reared on the American version, that is kind of their default, for better or for worse. And Australian Survivor was almost like the escape from the turn that American Survivor took in like the 30s in particular. Even though I would say in many regards, Australian Survivor is what those people regard as the worst excesses of American Survivor, like magnified to the extreme in some cases.
Yeah, I don't know, because it's just that with Australian Survivor, they do have very stupid twists and everything, but like I'm never living in fear that the whole season is going to be ruined because of it, like I am with the US version. So I mean for me, Australian Survivor, it started out as like, oh, I'm not going to care what this is because it's just something to watch while I'm, you know, waiting in between US seasons. But it didn't take long for this to become far superior in my eyes, and now I mean, this is, for me, this has proven to me that modern Survivor can still be good.
How much of that do you think is just the Australian seasons are so long that any one twist almost doesn't really have time to take over a season because it happens and then 14 episodes later, you know, you've had so much else has happened that you just forget about it by then?
Honestly, it's probably a big part of it, but also the fact that we get like 3 episodes per week, that if something happens where like there's a big twist that pisses you off, by the time, you know, the end of the week happens, you're not even thinking about it anymore. Or if you have like a random episode where someone doesn't go home, which is a necessary evil in this show, like, you know, like at least tomorrow someone's going to go home and this stupid twist may not even impact the game.
Yeah, it's almost like Australian Survivor doesn't have the same continuity in terms of twists, where if the tagline for an American season is, well, this is Edge of Extinction, you know that that's going to be a fundamental part of the season. We're going to be taking a visit there almost every single episode. And that becomes woven into the game in a way where Australian Survivor, it feels very much like, all right, okay, we got to find a twist for this week. How about any ideas, guys? And then they just take the first thing that someone comes up with and they throw that in. And then the next week, it's the same process. But there's never, you know, any twist where it's like grafted onto the game in a more fundamental sense.
Right. It seems like Australian Survivor, the twists are kind of like what this season of American Survivor is, season 41, where they just kind of, you know, take something, throw it at the wall for 1 week. If it works, then a lot of people are loving it. If it doesn't, then you roll your eyes and you move on to the next week. But the difference is, with Australian Survivor, they have like one twist a week kind of, but you get three episodes a week, and each of those episodes are like an hour to an hour and a half long. So you still get a bunch of other stuff. Even if you don't like the twist, there's so much other stuff to watch throughout the week that you are going to like. Whereas with Survivor, they're still doing these kind of like twists of the week, you know, two or three of them now in these first two episodes, but they kind of take up so much of the episode and you only get 40 minutes a week. And by the time they're done climbing up a mountain and doing Prisoner's Dilemma, they're at tribal council and you're like, what the hell just happened? And why did, you know, this person get voted out?
Yeah, I'm sure George or any of the other nerd archetypes on Australian Survivor could chime in to say, actually, this isn't a Prisoner's Dilemma because of X, Y, and Z or whatever. You know, Baden's on the Brain Tribe. I'm sure he could explain that as well. But this season also really started with a bang, with that advantage that George ended up getting, where he just got to divide the tribe in half and only half of them were going to go to that first tribal council. And I feel like that did a good job of weeding out the people who just weren't about that sort of thing. So Colin, for example, one of the reasons he's not in here talking about this right now is because he saw that and just noped out of the season after episode one. And given his reaction to that twist, that maybe is for the better. But that really was the high point in terms of how much an episode was affected by a twist like that. And then we had some kind of silly stuff later on, and there were just numerically a lot of twists, but none of them rose to the same heights as that one. And so if you were able to stomach that, then the rest of the season you were going to be fine with.
Exactly. That was the big one, and it scared people off, including Colin. And I tried my hardest to get him back on board, and he just never listened, no matter what. I was Facebook messaging him once a week, telling him to get back in on it. But yeah, even with, I mean, there was that other twist in like, you know, the early merge that ends, there's a couple of them, but they kind of like, there's so much stuff where usually when you have like a big stupid twist, it kind of usually ends up ending in like a non-elimination episode. So they kind of end up canceling each other out. So I never got too pissed off at them.
And that incessant nagging of Colin, that's a sign of love. You know, there are billions of people out there in the world, and you're not Facebook messaging, you know, most of them to tell them every week that they need to be watching Australian Survivor. I guess today you couldn't be Facebook messaging any of them to date this podcast a little bit. But, you know, you're in Colin's DMs because you care and you love him and you want him to love Australian Survivor in the same way. And that's really touching to me. Anyway, I think as well, though, once you're not there at the outset and you're already a few weeks into the show, which for this version, it means you're 15 episodes in and each of those episodes is at least an hour long. It is so tough to convince people to actually take the plunge and catch up at that point, because it really is such a staggering time commitment.
Yeah, but it's still so worth it, because I once or twice have been like, oh, it's, you know, 30 hours too long or whatever. But for me, if I'm enjoying something, and we'll get into Haley, but she just makes it worth it. And Haley is obviously all over the season. So like, even just having her there every episode, like, I was never dreading another episode coming. I was always looking forward to the next day and then dreading the 4 days where we weren't getting an hour and a half of Haley every day. And even if you have to, you know, watch it on 1.2 speed or 1.5 speed and skip challenges just to catch up, it's so worth it, just because we're getting, even with all the twists and some of the unbalanced editing, we're getting a season that is just so good and just so satisfying to watch all the way through.
Yeah, I guess that's my hang up, is that it feels like for most seasons of Australian Survivor, frankly, there are some high highs and some low lows, and I don't think the two of those necessarily go together. And it feels like if you had one of those YouTube highlight reels of a season that a lot of people like to do for Big Brother in particular, if you edited the season down into some 4 or 5 hour greatest hits montage, I would be all about that. I would love it because it feels like you can see all you need to see and still have about as good a sense of who most of the characters are, frankly, in that length of time. And you just skip all of the stuff in between where it's the same confessional that you've heard a dozen times before. And if you're as big a Hades stan as you are, then maybe you're fine with that. Or if you're a George stan, then hearing him say for the 34th time that he's a political operative, that just never gets old. That line is absolute gold to you. But for me, it feels like they really could be more selective about that. And I think it's a sign of having to edit up towards the schedule. Whereas like with US Survivor, one thing that you hear all the time is it would be so great if every episode was 90 minutes or 2 hours, right? Because there's so much that we don't get to see. It feels like the opposite is the case here, where it's being decreed from up on high by the network that, all right, we have this much time to fill and you need to find stuff to fill it. And it feels like they often don't do a great job filling that time. And it's more just taking what the right length version would have been if it was 1 or 2 episodes a week and just like scaling all of that exact same stuff up to fill that void.
Yeah. And I think if anyone was hesitant to watching the full season and a 4 or 5 hour version did just exist, that would be good. But I would also be the annoying person still pushing them to watch the whole season. And I think maybe, yeah, just cutting down on those excess repeat confessionals that we're hearing over and over again, and maybe cutting a couple minutes off the tribal councils, where maybe we can get the episodes that are an hour and a half, if we could get those down to like an hour, maybe that would be the sweet spot.
Yeah, those tribal councils can be such a drag as well. I think the other side of that is we complain all the time when someone gets this purple edit on American Survivor, and you kind of understand why that has to happen when time is at a premium. Here, time is absolutely not at a premium. And so when you have someone like a Chelsea, let's say, getting a single-digit number of confessionals and then getting medevaced out of the game, it's really hard to care or get invested in that when you just literally don't know who she is. Or like we've seen with Survivor 41, the adoption of, and I don't know if this was explicitly like pilfered from the Australian version, but these brief intro sequences where like their name flashes up on the screen and in the Australian version, it's very dramatic, right? Their just entire name and these giant block letters comes up and it's booming music and you have this great sequence. And so when you go like 10 episodes and then suddenly just the name Georgia just fills the entire thing and it's like, wait, who's Georgia again? It feels very all or nothing in that sense.
Yeah. Like if you're going to wait till episode 11 to give someone the big pre-intro package, maybe just don't do it at all, because it kind of flagged up that maybe this person might be going home.
Right. It's almost like a throwback to the days when if someone got a confessional after you hadn't heard from them for 5 weeks, like, oh, I guess it must be their boot episode. And yeah. Now we're having that on a whole new scale. But
yeah, this is the visibility spike times like 20.
Yeah. Were you optimistic then, given the recent history here, where usually if an all-star season flops, then it's almost like, well, how could it get better than that? Because in theory, these are the people you want to be seeing. These are the people playing the hardest and giving the best confessionals and so on. And it felt like none of that was really happening last season. And so did you think that if that was a sign of things to come, then this reboot was not going to get off the ground? Or are you in the camp where often the all-star seasons are the ones that get like derailed or wrapped up in themselves, and you often need a back to basic season to keep it fresh?
Right. After the all-star season was so bad, and I think by far the worst season of Australian Survivor, I was not optimistic. It kind of, that's really when they started going like overboard on some of these random twists just for no reason, even when they didn't have to. And I was starting to think like, now with like these Exile Island type things, are they kind of going to lean into be more like American Survivor? And now I'm just going to have two versions where I have to struggle to get through every year. But, you know, with the new cast coming out, it kind of snuck up on me. Like all of a sudden people were just like, oh, by the way, Australian Survivor starts next week. So I didn't even have like time to dread it. I was just like, oh, all right, I guess I'll get ready for it. And then once it started and I started people's started seeing people like already complaining about the first big twist that came up, I was like, oh no. So I was, my expectations were like almost as low as they could be. So when I came in, I was actually kind of pleasantly surprised. I thought, like, I don't know, I was thinking the twist was going to be like the worst thing that's ever happened, and it was pretty bad, but it wasn't terrible. And then by the end of the week, I was all in. I was enjoying it again. So it didn't take much with this cast. The people that we got to see from this cast really started making me excited 1 or 2 weeks in.
Yeah, I don't know if that twist was even that egregious in the grand scheme of things. It might be that it was exactly George who found that advantage and wanted to use it to take the biggest, wildest swing possible right out of the gate, where you have to imagine if Haley found it, for example, she wouldn't feel the need to use it that way and would probably be more conservative about if she even used it at all. Or, you know, if one of the many Andrews on the season, you know, were to find it instead and it's like, oh, that's cool, and then just who cares, right? But if it was anyone other than George, maybe there would be a lot less fanfare or complaining about that twist. But because it was George who found it, you knew there were going to be some fireworks no matter what.
Yeah, it's George that finds it, and it's the literal like first thing that happens in the season,
and that really sets a tone for the rest of the season and George's place in it, I think. And you really cannot evaluate the season without talking about George for most of that, because I believe he has officially broken the confessional count for any contestant on any season of International Survivor, and it may be actually breaking David's record from the very last season of this version, actually. So George is certainly the main character in every sense of the word here. What was your initial reaction to George, and did that evolve over time at all?
I hated him at first, and it was a real up and down roller coaster. At times I liked him. He's just like the typical person that kind of like goes hard and then the edit, you know, rewards him by shoving him down our throats. And by the way, we can say whatever we want about him because George does, in fact, have me blocked on Twitter. So,
wait, what? Hold on. We can't just skip past that. We need the details here.
I don't know what happened because first of all, obviously I'm not like adding him on Twitter, and nothing I said, like I was complaining about him like every week for a while, but nothing I said was like too egregious. But I saw a tweet that kind of had the final three tagged, and I went to go look at all their profiles, and I could not look at George's profile because he had me blocked. So it is to my understanding that he just blocks, you know, anybody that he sees is saying like negative things about him. So good for him, I guess. I don't hate him as much as there's plenty of people I hate more. But anyway, like I said, it was a roller coaster because at least with him, he Unlike a Rick Devins, who was making similar grandiose moves and getting, you know, confessional shoved down our throats and everything, at least with George, it seemed like he was not claiming these moves were like his own, and at least giving other people the respect that was due to them. Like, he was calling Haley a queen all the time. He was giving her props for saving her in the game. When a vote didn't go his way, he wasn't like pretending like it was his big plan. He was like telling people on their way out, like, by the way, it actually wasn't me that voted for you. I don't know what happened. So there were times where George started to grow on me, and then it would just, again, would just be so overboard where, you know, by the end of the week, I'd start hating him again. So it was a real sine curve up and down with him.
Oh, that's the stats homework or whatever really shining through here. You know, you can tell how he spent the rest of your day here.
Tell I was studying for 10 days, for 10 hours, right, before I got on here.
But that's the ultimate sign of a poor social game, I think, is having you blocked on Twitter. Like, if that feels really, like, yeah, I mean, what better metric is there? But yeah, I found that the George archetype is less and less my thing over time, and maybe like 5 years ago or whatever, I would have had more appreciation for him. But it was clear from very early on that it's like, all right, the whole season is just going to be more and more of this until he maybe gets voted out. But after a certain point, it felt like that's just never, ever going to happen, is it? Like, we are stuck with this guy until the bitter end. And yeah, I think at points he was more self-aware than some other people in that archetype have been in the past. And even though, you know, he was proud and maybe rightfully so of his own game, and he was reveling in his position of power, he didn't really take that so far as like belittling on the other people or talking incessantly about how stupid they were, which is apparently very easy to do based on the standards that some people have set. So I did appreciate that about him. But it felt like as him getting further and further in the season became inevitable, and maybe it wasn't going to be him winning or him losing in the finals. Maybe he would be that person who falls just short, but they're like the what if question of, oh, if they just won one more challenge, which George was never going to do, so we don't need to indulge that possible universe. But that person who people talk about as one of the best to never win, right, because they come so close and then they fall just short and there's still that question mark around them. But if you told me past a certain point that George is going to get to the end, it's going to be, well, okay, either he's against Kara and he gets every vote and his fans will be bigging him up as the best player who ever lived, or he's going to lose maybe to Haley, maybe to someone else. And this could very easily be another, robbed goddess kind of situation.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I thought there was not a chance in hell that he was going to make a deep run. Because he comes on very strong and he makes enemies right off the bat. And he, like, it is said multiple times, like, he's going to be the first person out once we go to Tribal Council. And then I remember Rob came on the podcast with Shannon at the end of episode one. He was like, I'm going to enjoy George for as long as he's here, so pretty much the next two episodes. And I completely agreed. And I was like, all right, it's fine that they're shoving him down our throat because they probably know that we only have like 2 weeks with this guy and then he's going to be gone. So they want to get their money's worth. But then, you know, he finds an idol here. Someone else randomly plays an idol for him there. And, you know, before you know it, he has somehow made the merge. And then once he made the merge, it kind of like he found his footing and was able to just find a path to the end and get there. But I mean, I personally obviously don't feel that he's one of the best to never win or robbed goddess or anything, because when, you know, if he was able to get to the end with Kara and win, that would have been a good game. But like getting to the end with Haley, you just see like all the flaws just in his social game when she just completely annihilated him in that final Tribal Council.
And honestly, if we only had a week or two of George and he comes in and he launches this failed hit on Mitch and then comes a cropper, goes out episode two or episode three, iconic, you know, one of the best first or second boots of all time, you know, really giving us what we came here for. But it almost felt like George never had to suffer any consequences for ever getting anything wrong, where, you know, he... anyone else, they take that swing at Mitch, they're gone next, right? But George is able to kind of claw his way up, and you give him some credit for being able to do that, but you then, over time, it becomes how much of this is George getting himself back in the graces of the group, and how much of it is either just being bailed out by a swap or something where he makes the obvious flip that, of course, you have to make, and he's only safe past that point precisely because he's such at odds with his former tribe mates that of course the Brawns are going to scoop him up because he has nowhere else to go. And how much of it is just finding an idol, finding an advantage at the right time, or when Kara gets bailed out after her own, you know, comical string of mistakes. If George doesn't have Kara there, I think it's a totally different game. But having that sounding board and that reliable second vote gave George this unique position that no one else really had.
Yeah, I mean, look at George's pre-merge game. Like, he finds that big advantage right off the bat and is able to save himself and whoever he wants so that he's not the first one voted out. Then he, you know, his tribe wins like three immunity challenges in a row. Then it looks like it's going to be him, but he finds an idol and is able to just throw that in everyone's face so that someone else is the target. Then Kara, for really no reason, just plays an idol on him, and he doesn't even lose her because, like you said, she comes right back. And then Haley, just because she wanted to be iconic, like this was her big coming out party, she just felt like she needed to save George, and for good reason, to take a shot at the power structure there. But you know, she saves him, and the next thing you know, it's a swap, and he got whatever the opposite of swap screwed is. He just, you know, by the time he swaps, he finds himself in a good spot, and he's able to make the merge. Like he got very, very lucky.
Yeah, and I wonder if the character of George becomes even more exaggerated in a Brains versus Brawn season, where I think even if this was a Champions versus Contenders Part 3 or whatever, then he still would have made it on because casting saw the potential in him. I don't think he was cast just because he was a brain, but he feels like the almost like the caricature of the brain archetype. And if you're trying to set up that contrast, what better person to do it with than George of all people?
Mm-hmm. Do you think George knows what 1/6 is equal to?
I mean, fractions are a very advanced concept, you know. Jeff Rose himself constantly flummoxed by them, so yeah,
maybe gushing over George.
Maybe that's what they ask him in casting, you know. Can you do basic arithmetic? But it felt like, in keeping with Australian Survivor in general, they almost had this overflow of the strong, silent athlete type, and so some of them, like Baden, just ended up on the brain tribe because, well, we've already filled out our roster of 10 brawns, and now I guess we still want Baden on the season, so he's got to go somewhere.
Yeah, Baden and Andrew both were like very, very brawn in spirit, but somehow ended up on the brain tribe. And I think they justified everyone like in the first couple of episodes, but I was not paying attention as to why they were actually on the brain tribe.
Yeah, it kind of feels to me sometimes like every guy on Australian Survivor is either a George or an Andrew, right? They're either the the self-appointed mastermind who won't shut up about how great they are, and most of them go down in flames at some point, or they're some ex-professional athlete who doesn't quite seem to know what Survivor is or where they are or why they're there, and, you know, maybe you hear from them once every five episodes, and there's really no space in between. And I guess the Golden God himself, you know, is a rare exception insofar as he just kind of effortlessly glided to the end and crushed every facet of the game. But even the All-Star season, you had like Henry and AK and Nick and Harry and so on and so forth. And I'm sure as people, there's so much between them and so on. But on Australian Survivor, to me, they all just kind of collapsed into the same character. And that was part of why I struggled to enjoy that season. It's like, well, instead of having this diverse cast of 20, 24 different people, it's, well, here's five people who are all the same guy, and then here's five people who we never see anything out of, despite them being All-Star, so why are they here in the first place? And you see what I'm saying here, right?
Yeah, I guess. And for me, it's like, there are definitely, like, you know, there's going to be five Badens roaming around at any given time. But I guess just because since it is a cast of, like, 24, if I'm going to have six people that all kind of blend together and I can't really tell the difference, I'm not going to mind it that much, just because I think there are just going to be so many iconic characters that I can focus my attention on that, you know, maybe, you know, the other people that I don't care about can just serve as cannon fodder, and then, you know, they can all get voted out one by one by one, and I'll just have a nice week where I don't have to cry about any of my favorites going home.
Yeah, you enjoy the 10 minutes of Haley you get, and then the other 80 minutes, you can just pad that out with whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if Baden's gonna, you know, be Haley's right-hand man at some point and help her out, then, you know, I'm gonna root for Baden as well.
Yeah, so one of the Baden plus Haley scenes that we should talk about is, of course, them on Redemption Rock, which we couldn't even spring for a full island. Like, the budget wouldn't go that far, but they get to Redemption Rock, and in the past, so when this idea of someone actually coming back into the game in a permanent way was something we had to take seriously on American Survivor, at first I took a very hardline stance on that. I was thinking, well, I just wouldn't vote for that person if I was on the jury, because they've already been voted out, and even if they were there at the end against someone who I didn't like and didn't respect, it would be so tough for me to just get over the fact that, you know, the rule of Survivor typically is you play until you get voted out, and you have been voted out, so why should I even give you a fair hearing there? And I think my take on that has softened a little bit over time, and I didn't feel that this season, but I don't know how much of that is just motivated reasoning, because, hey, I like Haley and I respect Haley's game, as opposed to, you know, I guess, like, yeah, Chris Underwood crushed it when he came back in, but I didn't really want him to come back in the first place, you know?
Yeah, I'm completely with you there, and I, much like you, at first I was like, well, if you get voted out, that's it. The point of the game is to not get voted out, so if you get voted out, I can't justify, you know, rooting for you to win in the end, but I also have softened on that, and am I a little biased because it is Haley? I mean, probably, but I have, like, a whole list of reasons why I just, at least for Haley specifically, that I do not care that it was that she got voted out and came back in and then went on to win the game. I think she is just as deserving as anyone, and obviously even more so.
Yeah, I think in Australian Survivor, it's easier for me to accept that as just part of the game. And I don't know how much of that is holding the American version to a higher standard in a way that's kind of unfair to both camps here. But for Australian Survivor, it's very clear that these big game-shattering twists are just part of the game. And if you make it through those unscathed, then at least in the eyes of the other contestants, it seems like you have as much legitimacy as anyone else. And I remember in Haley's deep dive with Shannon, she was saying, you know, the topic of she had been voted out, she was expecting George to raise that at the final tribal, but he didn't make a big deal out of it. And none of the jury members made a big deal out of it in the way that as an American superfan, maybe you would expect that they would.
Yeah, exactly. And much like you, at least to start out, Australian Survivor was just like, all right, I don't need to take this as seriously as I take regular Survivor. This will just be for fun. So if someone gets voted out and gets screwed by a twist, comes back in, whatever, I'm not going to care. But as I've said, this has now become like what I'm most into. And I still don't really care, maybe because I just always viewed Australian Survivor as like, this is a necessary evil. They need to have filled 24 episodes. And instead of expanding the cast where we're going to get even more invisible people, they need to have some non-elimination rounds. So it just kind of comes with it. And for Haley specifically in this one, she was only on, her and Baden were only on Redemption Rock because they got screwed by a stupid twist to begin with. So it, yes. kind of just canceled out for me. And then also she gets voted out and then immediately comes back in, which I think is very huge. She doesn't miss any actual game time, and she doesn't miss any episodes. Like, by the end of the episode that she gets voted out in, she is right back in. And I think when it comes to that, like, I don't see how that's any different by getting saved by, like, another twist, like, say, an idol or an advantage that you find. And her actually having to, like, beat Baden to come back in is actually more impressive to me than just being like, oh, I might go home tonight. Let me look for a stick. And then you find it, and then you just happen to, you know, get all the votes, but you're able to save yourself because you luckily found an idol. So this is even more impressive to me that she actually had to win something to come back in. She didn't actually miss any game time, and she comes back in at final 10 and still has to make it all the way to the end. And the fact that she does kind of just shows that it was kind of a fluke that she was there to begin with. Like, it wasn't like a Ben Driebergen thing where it's like, oh, you're gonna go home, let's do a fire making twist, and not only do you get to knock someone else out, but you're automatically in final 3. Haley came back in and then actually, like, she didn't win out towards the end of the way. She had to come back in and reintegrate herself into the tribe after getting voted out and still make her way to the end. So she still very impressive to me. So I think Haley specifically, and then I'm rambling now, but and then when you look at the entire final five, every single person in the final five was saved by a twist or an advantage at some point, and three of them were actually voted out. So
yeah,
if you wanted to be like, I'm not going to vote for someone who was saved by a twist, you could not have that philosophy because every single person was in the final five.
Right, and maybe that makes it more risky to even try to make that argument, because it's implicitly saying, like, fuck you to three people on the jury at the same time.
Exactly.
So yeah, once you have a possible final three in which every single person there had been technically saved from elimination one way or another, then yeah, maybe that argument loses its punch. And as you mentioned, conceptually, there's no real difference between saving yourself or being saved in the case of many people here with an idol and getting your way back in through some other means. And if you ask some of the true hardline old school fans, I think that's exactly what they would tell you, right? It's the game lost that purity in a way that it could never get back once the idea of the hidden immunity idol really came into play in that way. So yeah, I don't think it's fundamentally different from any of those. And as you say, Haley did not do like the Chris Underwood or Natalie Anderson
Super Mario
warp pipe style thing.
She was not gifted an idol upon coming back in. This was not a Chris Underwood or even a Devins. This was not a, you know, this is not an, I can't even think of what it was. I blocked it out. The Island of Extinction or whatever it was called. It's not a that situation. Like, it's completely different to me.
Yeah, she wasn't missing any of the votes there. Like, she was there for basically every tribal council that she would have been at otherwise. And then was able to convert it from there, despite having come back in. And in a season where that doesn't disqualify you by default, the way that, in theory, some people think like it should, she has a heightened threat level coming back in, right? And yet, despite that, she was able to work her way back into the group and then get herself into a power position again. And so in a game where, yeah, I think there's a lot of luck involved, there's a lot of stuff outside your control, there have been people in the past who were truly playing well, and then something just hits them from out of the blue, and they get voted out or whatever because of it. And we think of those people as, oh, what could have been? And Haley shows us what could have been here, right? She gets that second chance, and she makes the most of it. But as you alluded to, going back to the circumstances of her getting voted out in the first place there, it was because there was one person voting in that previous round where it seemed like she was going to be the one going home first and not Baden. And that was Danny, who Haley had just alienated in the worst possible way, essentially, by kind of like poaching her own move and then having her become the decoy as part of it, which is truly an alpha move, but not the best way of, buying the gratitude of someone who, unluckily for her, was going to have all the power shortly thereafter. And Haley, in her deep dive, she identified this as the one clear mistake, which, hard to have regrets when you win, but looking back, you know, if you could change anything, this is a thing where maybe that pre-merge move against Simon could have been executed with a little bit more finesse, where, you know, Danny gets to believe that she has ownership of it and there's no kind of jostling for credit there.
Yeah, but it's also just so iconic to watch her take someone else's move, someone else's blindside, and just completely steal it and make it her own. And I get, in hindsight, it was kind of a mistake, but no one's ever going to foresee that Danny is somehow going to become the only vote in like two tribal councils from them. And just the fact that she was able to, if that it just wasn't her, like Danny actually votes out Baden with her one vote. And just the fact, even for Haley to survive that, was incredible to me.
Mm-hmm. One thing which I think doesn't get spoken about enough in terms of how the season plays out is Chelsea gets evacuated, and it's easy to miss that because it was easy to miss Chelsea on the season. But in terms of setting up the following round, where the numbers line up exactly for George, in to give him his due, in his best move of the season, maybe, to pull off this amazing Gerald option C blindside out of nowhere, that ends up being on like this 5-4-1 margin, which if there's one more vote in the equation there, I don't know if that plan can really come together. And so I think Chelsea leaving under those circumstances, you know, maybe that screws a player like Emmett or Danny more than anyone else.
Yeah, probably. Definitely screw them, because those were, I guess, her closest allies in the game, I would assume, because like you said, we really didn't see much from Chelsea, which is another thing I guess they should work on. Like, I understand she's getting medevaced at some point, so you don't want everyone too invested in her, but to just, like, give her nothing and then just to have her unceremoniously leave was a little bit rude to her. But it kind of just has it work out perfectly so that as soon as she leaves, they have the perfect amount of numbers for George to pull off this move, as Haley is just getting back into the game, so she can kind of like quietly reintegrate herself in there. And it was just the perfect storm for that move.
Mm-hmm. And then as we move past that point, you know, we lose Emmett eventually, who, he's just so weird, right? And like, I could never quite get a handle on Emmett, or just how much of this is a bit, how much of this is how he actually is as a person. But I almost like that he was giving something new and refreshing, and he wasn't just, an Andrew type or whatever who had just randomly acquired power.
I grew to love him. At first, I was rolling my eyes at him. I was like, oh, great. We have one of these guys. This guy's going to think he's running the game. It's going to be really annoying. I can't wait for his downfall. But I really grew to enjoy him. Like, he kind of had a sense of the game, which is kind of surprising. Like, he wasn't just an idiot. Like, he kind of knew what he was doing at certain points. Like, obviously, he's going to get outplayed by Haley. But, you know, in a season where Haley's not there, maybe he could make some more damage. But, and he was also just like having fun every step of the way. He always had a goofy grin on his face. He never took anything too seriously. Like, he was always a very good sport about everything. And he never, even though he was serving like as the villain role, he never seemed like malicious at any point. And by the end of the game, where he's like voting for Haley and singing her praises, I was pumping my fist, giving him a standing ovation.
Yeah, I think that's, and this is why I appreciated Joey too. I think it's so nice when the people who are running the show seem like they're having fun and they're not just, yes, you know, methodically doing their job or whatever, and especially if they're going to have some hilarious downfall eventually, it's so nice if you can kind of be laughing with them and at them at the same time, rather than just one of the two.
Yeah, and that's kind of like what happened with David. Like, when his first time he plays, like, he was kind of the villain, but he was having fun the whole time, and we were laughing with him, and he was laughing and not taking anything too seriously. And then it felt like when he came back for All-Stars, like, he kind of started off the same way, but eventually by the end, it just turned into, like, business for him, and it just didn't, it did not seem fun anymore.
Well, to me, the read I had, it was almost like, it was too much fun in the sense that he was toying with his food. It's like, nothing that I do matters because I'm going to win this game and I'm going to be just like randomly mean to Phoebe for no reason. I'm going to just, I can just do whatever I want and never be challenged at any point. And it's not like, oh, he's punching down now or whatever or anything. Mm-hmm. It's just like, I don't know. I think it's easier to appreciate that character when they kind of, they sit on their throne and immediately the legs of that throne get chopped out from underneath them versus they're just there from day one and you know that their reign is never going to end.
Exactly, yeah. And he got, like you were saying, he got kind of like mean-spirited in that season in a way where like Emmett and Joey never did in this one.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Wei quickly because I'm not a Quokka myself, but I am a Quokka ally, and so I really appreciated the representation that the Wei gave to the season here.
I love Wei, and I'm very happy that everyone was very pissed off about this twist to start things off, but it saved Wei, and I'm very happy about that.
Yeah, I think with Wei, she is that person who, when she gets voted out, and people say, well, why wouldn't you just drag Wei to the end? It would be an easy win. And then it turns out that despite what the fans want to project as being a deserving game or whatever, they're just so well-liked that they probably would have won regardless. And so, yeah, you have to take them out because if you want to win yourself, you can't leave them around anymore.
And I get it because I really liked her too. And I wouldn't have minded people voting for her and her winning. I just don't, like, you know, strategy-wise, I don't know. Was she a fan of the game or was she just, like, a recruit? I don't know why I'm asking, assuming that you know, but...
Oh, I'm not a fan enough to know if Wei herself is a fan. I'm just... I'm the recruit on this podcast. You are the true super fan.
True, that is true. Because I was just trying to figure out like what Wei was thinking at certain points of the game. Because at certain points, she kind of seemed like tuned out and she didn't care what was happening. But then, you know, out of nowhere, she gets picked up by Haley. And now they're kind of like making strategic decisions down the line. So I was kind of all over the place with Wei. But like I said, very, very glad that she was there.
Yeah, I don't think we're getting any more extensive interviews or whatever from the season, but Wei is someone who I think it would be useful to hear from, not because she was doing much herself to like affect the course of the game, but sometimes because she wasn't. It's because, you know, she had these opportunities, it seemed like, at points where her one vote or her being on board with the plan could have changed everything, but she chose to play it a certain way instead, perhaps. and just hearing about why she did or didn't do those things, I think would, you know, give some of the useful context to some of the moves that the Haley and George did make that they're giving credit for.
I loved when she broke up with George early in the game, too. That was pretty compelling.
Yeah, that kind of on-again, off-again tiff was one of those nice, low-key storylines. Let's talk about Kara quickly as well, because she... what do you have to say about Kara? I'm not sure I can really put it into words there.
I think she cooked it. She's one of the most legendary moves of all time. I mean, how she just nonsensically gives George an idol, gets voted out, and comes right back in, and that isn't her most iconic move is kind of amazing on her part. But to completely just mess up a vote split in a way that no one has ever seen before, and before I watched that episode, I was already seeing things on Twitter like, what was that tribal? What happened? So I was already kind of expecting something, but it even took me by surprise. I was like, oh my god, I cannot believe what's happening. So it is something that can only happen to a player like Kara, where she it's just a nonsensical player where anything can happen.
Yeah, I love those accidental agents of chaos who don't mean to screw up the game for even their closest allies sometimes, but just bumble their way into doing it because they don't know how to do anything else.
Oh, man. Yeah, she was amazing to watch. And like you mentioned earlier, she was a big part of George's game. And if I bet if he could have had things his way, he would have ended up in the final two with Kara. But I mean, it was even compelling watching them have to turn on each other at final four.
Yeah, let's touch on that, because that was just as an event in itself, the two of them finally having to turn on each other. That was something which it felt like we were never going to see by choice. It was going to be either George and Kara get to the end together, or maybe they both get to final three or something, or final four, and then whoever wins, because it's probably not going to be one of those two, if we're being honest, I picked one of them, probably Kara, to go to the end, and that's how perhaps George becomes the you know, the player who almost had it in the bag. But yeah, to see that finally happen was great, and under those circumstances too, where if anyone else wins immunity, it feels like Flick just goes home and it's a simple vote. Although I don't know if does Haley, I guess she knows that she could win any challenge against the two of them regardless. So yeah, you take out the one person who could also win a challenge and you're fine. But that changed it from what would have been a very boring vote into suddenly a fascinating vote, where maybe Haley is under the gun in a serious way for the first time since she came back in, and there's nowhere to hide. There's no fifth person who you can set up as an easy alternative. Either you're going home, you being Haley, or George and Kara have to turn on each other. So let's get to work and let's make that happen.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously we have to talk about Haley with this move. I mean, she did so much, and this still might have been her move of the game. Like, I thought we were done with iconic Haley moments, but she brought it up until the very end, where she loses Final Four. She's vulnerable. Like, obviously, like, on paper, it looks like the most obvious thing in the world, where she has to go home, especially when Flick is voting for Haley. And just for her to pull it off in a way that made sense, and not to go off on a tangent, but this is why, for me, like, as long as Australian Survivor still has a round of four and a round of three and an actual endgame, it is always going to be superior to U.S. Survivor. Because just imagine this round just ending in a fire-making challenge. It would be the worst thing ever. Like, there's no stakes there ever. Instead, we get this amazing, legendary Final Four round where Haley is just able to not only get George to turn on Kara, but also get Kara to turn on George, and then she ends up being the deciding vote to send who goes up. You can only see something like that in Australian Survivor.
Yeah, and that happening in conjunction with this amazing Final Four round on Survivor South Africa at the same time, I think that really has driven home the contrast between how exciting the endgame can be in a Final Two versus a Final Three, where the argument when the Final Three first came in, and which I bought into for a long time, was, well, yeah, of course, they're just going to vote out the obvious threat to win, and then it's going to be a less exciting contest in the Final Two most of the time, or that person wins a challenge themselves or gets taken, and then they win and blow out. And either way, you know, a lot of the suspense is lost there at the end. But I think without the inevitability of that to work backwards from, you just don't get as interesting a final stretch here, where, yeah, especially now, like you say, with the fire-making challenge, it's maybe there's some sense of a storytelling tragedy or whatever if Kara and George have to go up against each other, although I guess that can't really happen. Or you can see how...
Whatever happens, it's so, like, manufactured. Like, it's,
yes.
Like, yeah. Not only are we missing the round of three and the round of four, but, like, also... most of the times, easiest, because we have such big casts, there are eight people left when we get down to the final two episodes. So we're doing a double tribal in the penultimate episode to get it down to six. Then we have six people in the finale, and we only have, you know, 2.5 hours to get through that. So we have to rush through all of that. We see virtually no endgame. And yes, sometimes an endgame is going to be boring. And sometimes if you have a final two, the best player is going to get voted out at three, and that's going to be heartbreaking. But a lot of times, you're going to get moments like this, where in the final three of this season of Australian Survivor, we have this epic saw contraption where they're all, like, hanging on for dear life while standing on spikes, and you see Flick is struggling, getting back with their loved ones all looking on. It was very emotional to me as someone who is very invested in the journey of these people by this point, and to watch it all play out, like Australian Survivor does the finale episode so well, even though there's only three people there every season. Like, it's just something we are missing out on 100% of the time in the way that U.S. Survivor does things.
Yeah, and having the families there too, I think, is a great innovation for that, where it really just brings home how much it means. And we've seen it in the past where these players who in other respects are great Survivor players, but they have this loyalty to one person who, if they're being honest with themselves, they admit they probably couldn't beat, but they just want to stick with their team. You know, they want to stick with their ride or die. And I think having your loved one there who, if you stay loyal to this person, you are making a direct choice of giving this relative stranger however much the prize money is over, you know, your husband or your kid or whoever who's standing there. That really brings home the stakes, I think, in a way that makes that end game even more exciting.
Yeah, and I want to watch that struggle. It's something that I am very invested in watching.
And it is actually a lot of money this season too, where it's you know, Survivor South Africa, they go for that nice round figure of $1 million, but it's R1 million, which you type it into the Google currency conversion. It's okay, it's a nice chunk of change, but it's the equivalent of like the Big Brother Canada prize money, right? Not including the home shopping spree at the Brick.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that they can't splurge a little and get them some more prize money.
Yeah. What did you, as a quick segue, did you find yourself liking the location here? Because I think for this season to happen at all, it was going to happen in Australia. And Australia is a much better place to have to do this domestically if you're trying to maintain this kind of exotic, faraway location vibe than, you know, if you're filming US Survivor domestically, you're not going to just cut everyone off to Idaho or something to, you know, maybe you could make it work, but it doesn't have quite the same energy to it. Whereas Australia is, you know, it has been a location for other international Survivor seasons to use as their filming site in the past, because this is in the same vein as, you know, Fiji or the Cook Islands or wherever, as, oh wow, that's a cool faraway place, so let's see them go there. So yeah, if, when they have to go to the Gold Coast or whatever, then I think they're fine with that, you know, even if maybe that seems less romantic if you are Australian yourself and you're used to that.
Yeah, and even though I'm not someone who really cares where they play or even gonna notice that much if they're playing a different place, it is nice to, you know, get a reality TV show away from Fiji for once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and with, it seems like US Survivor having resumed business as usual back in Fiji there, I don't see that changing anytime soon either. So we're going to be stuck there with the same backdrop and locations there for a while. So nice to have just non-Fiji Survivor as a nice palate cleanser for once.
Exactly.
I guess, how closely were you following Survivor South Africa as well?
Not at all. I know that the Merge episode was the best episode of television of all time, because I was reading tweets about the Merge episode of that season for, I think, like a month and a half.
Oh, God. Was it the Merge episode that was that? Maybe I need to brush up on that myself before I end up.
It was somewhere around, somewhere around then, but I know there was a very iconic episode that everyone loved.
Yeah, there were some great episodes along the way there that hopefully Colin, who I think did see that season to its completion, or will have by the time you're hearing this,
Make a trade with Colin. I'll watch South Africa if he watches Australia. Maybe he'll be down for that.
Yeah, well, neither of us have proved successful in convincing him, so we need to, you know, we need someone like Haley maybe to show us the ropes there.
Yeah, I South Africa, I'm sure is very good, but I know once I get into it, I'm going to want to watch all the other seasons, and who has the time for that? I already have Australian Survivor taking up all my time.
Yeah, and if you're watching Australian Survivor, that is a full-time job in and of itself. So exactly. I respect you managing to balance that and your studying and so on. That's a real commitment.
Exactly.
Yeah, so we're going to get down to our final two here. It's Haley versus George, and Haley, I'll say predictably, because I felt like that is what was going to happen once we had that final two pairing, but it seemed like Haley was not too concerned based on her interview about, you know, when you go back to that final four round. I think if she had her druthers, she would want to have taken Kara there instead, but Kara wasn't giving her a firm commitment, so she did what she had to do. If you're worried about the difference between the two of them as opponents, if you think that you can beat Kara for sure, but George might be a harder thing, maybe you push harder and maybe you take that risk, but it seemed like she was pretty secure that all she had to do was make it to the end and she was going to have it locked up.
Yeah, I think she had to know she's beating anyone except for Flick. I mean, she did kill the final tribal performance and George did not, but I think it was, you know, very likely decided before that. And I think she probably had a good feeling about that.
Yeah, it is. In one regard, it's been interesting seeing the fan reaction to the season. And I'm thinking here about the Australian online fan reaction, which maybe is coming from a different place. I mean, I guess literally it is coming from a different place, but it is different assumptions are coming into it than in the American fan base, where you would think for Australia there would be a lot more emphasis on the challenges, and we are past the mateship era of Australian Survivor, but I think some of the same assumptions about just like physical strength, and especially for a guy to win Survivor, like you ought to be physically strong, like that's part of what the deal is, and George had as little of that as possible, and yet the same way that you know Russell had a very vigorous camp defending him in his seasons, there are a lot of people saying that, like, oh, these people are just so salty that George beat them, and how can't they appreciate what a great game he played, when I'm sure back in the first episode a lot of them were thinking, like, oh, who is this idiot who is such a weak link in the challenges, and he's making all these stupid moves, and he's kind of this loud, bratty nerd or whatever. It feels like a lot of people really went on this conversion and this emotional journey with George here.
Yeah, to make George losing about somehow like a bitter jury just does not make any sense at all to me, especially because, like, I have not seen any of these comments, but based on, like, the podcast I was listening to, apparently they did not like when he was just giving up on challenges and sitting them out, but then the very next week they were very quick to forgive him and say that he should have been the winner. But like you said, when you look, you just see in his first few episodes how he's so easily able to rub people the wrong way. He was never going to be a physical threat, and like just looking at who he was up against, like, even if you want to say, yeah, George did some pretty impressive moves. He you know, did the whole double agent thing where he told them about where to play the idol. He did that final 10 move against Gerald. He saved himself at final 5. All very impressive moves. But when you look at who he's up against, Haley had just as many good moves, but like even more than him. And she wasn't getting on everyone's nerve like George was. And like you could, like, to perfectly put into context both of their games, when Gerald asks the jury question that I really liked, and he was like, if the game reset and you guys were to come back in, who here would you be able to work with? And George says, I would be able to work with none of you. And Haley's like, I'd be able to work with all of you. I mean, that just shows exactly why Haley won and why George did not.
Yeah, and when Emmett got up to ask his question too, and he dropped that goofy persona for just a moment here to take it seriously. And it felt like, I think his mind was made up. I think he was always voting for Haley, but he did try to give George some rope here. He gave him an opportunity to say his piece and to be humble, which I think was really lacking from that final tribal performance. And you could see Emmett just visibly getting more and more frustrated as he was asking George the same basic thing over and over again, and George was just not reading the room. Like, he just wasn't accepting that. And I think that's the issue here, is George, it's easy to buy into when you've heard 160 confessionals or whatever of George saying that he's a political operative and he's masterminding the whole game. I think even the skeptics, once you hear that often enough, it's just brute repetition. It gets drummed into your brain. But I think you could definitely see coming why they didn't respect his game in its whole, because so many parts of it were just missing, you know? So this, people love nowadays to do like the, oh, it's outwit, outplay, outlast, and so that matches on to like social and physical and strategic or whatever. And if you divide it that way, just for the sake of argument, then strategically, I would say Haley was better than George, but okay, give it to George if you want to, just to indulge it. Socially, George was often pretty terrible, it looked like, and had to be rescued by other people, including Haley, whereas no one had a bad word to say about Haley at any point, it seemed like, even her rivals in the game, which is pretty rare. And then physically, Haley was dominant, right? You know, all-time great challenge performance by a woman on, you know, any season of Survivor, whereas George was one of the literal worst of all time who was made it that far in the game, and almost Big D levels of just failing to win challenges here, where I don't know if it's exaggerated on a Brains versus Braun season where that is explicitly what they're setting up, but I think more so on Australian Survivor than anywhere else, you cannot afford to just be actively not caring about the challenges. I think, you know, we saw with like Wei, for example, yeah, she wasn't performing that well herself, but she tried. Bless her heart, she really tried. And people gave her a lot of credit for that. They respected that. Whereas George just sitting out the challenges because he can't be bothered and he's not going to win anyway. That is such a bad look that no jury is actually going to want to reward.
Yes, especially in an Australian Survivor season where these players seem to care more about that stuff. And especially in a Brain versus Braun season where you're going to have like ex-professional athletes and even
right,
people, that were, on the, yeah, even people like, that were on even people that were on the Brains tribe were still pretty brawny. To like, I don't care if George is giving his all in challenges. Does it make sense to always give your all in challenges? Probably not. But you actually have to make the effort because, like you said, it's just such a bad look to just not even try in these challenges when you know that some people on this jury are like going to take that personally for whatever reason. And on top of that, like you said, Haley is, she won, I think, 4 immunity challenges. And at that final 4 move, like her argument is basically, you have to keep me in because you suck at challenges so much that I am the only person that can beat Flick and you're not going to be able to beat Flick. So like Haley's kept in the game specifically because she can beat in a challenge and George cannot. And everyone knows it.
Yeah. I do think we are seeing a soft trend across all forms of Survivor really towards challenges mattering a bit more or being respected a little bit more than maybe they were a few years ago. But even just on top of that, I wonder if those rare examples of when people have been able to get away with it, so, you know, Dr. Will and Big Brother or Sandra and Survivor, I wonder if that's really poisoned people's brains and led them to write off the importance of challenges in the minds of jury members and stuff more than they should, where like, yeah, those who can get away with it because they have so much else going for them or the circumstances of their seasons or whatever, whereas I don't think you can just rock up to Final Tribal completely tanking what many people see as, you know, an equal third of the game and expect to get away with it.
Yeah, the difference between George and Dr. Will and Sandra is George does not have an ounce of the charm that those two have. Like, they can sit out a challenge with a smile on their face and you're going to laugh and love them for it. George is not that player, and he can't be that player.
Yeah, I think if you crush the social aspect of the game, honestly, the other two don't really matter. I think that, right, that goes exactly, so yeah. far. And people want to find excuses for you. You know, if you suck at challenges, but you do it in a lovable way, then, hey, that's almost an argument in your favor, right? You didn't need those challenges to win. Whereas if people already think you're a little sus and then you're also doing badly in the challenges, well, that's an easy hook, an excuse for why it's the right thing not to vote for George, as opposed to I'm not voting for him because fuck that guy.
Exactly, and that is why Survivor is a social game when it comes down to it, or at least it should be. I don't know, jury's still out on what season 41 is going to be, but hopefully they get back to their roots and it is a social game above all else.
Yeah, hopefully that part of things does not age too badly. But I think the comparison that really jumps out for me might be Cochrane, actually, right? Where it's almost like, I think George played the kind of game that you might expect someone like Cochrane to play, where, okay, they find a chance to use their gigantic brain and their strategic chops, but they're lacking in the other components. Whereas Cochrane, the season he wins, playing the statistically perfect game that people like to bring up, you know, yeah, he I think did play a flawless strategic game, but then also people really liked the guy, and he was actually surprisingly a challenge beast somehow as well.
He had 4 immunity wins in that season.
Just as the cherry on top there. So he crushed every component of that, whereas yes. George, it was like, you know, very clearly behind on 2 out of 3, and then on the one thing which should be his crowning area, well, I think Haley was beating him to the punch there as well.
Right. The one thing he had going for him, he just happened to be up against the only other person who had a better strategic game, probably.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if we're going to be seeing either the two of them or anyone else from the season back in the near future. I guess they could do some kind of like they did with Luke, where he is the only one coming back. It would not actually shock me to see George just popping up on next year's edition of Australian Survivor, which I guess would not be Australian Survivor anymore without its namesake queen in the mix. But I mean, maybe like a rival season or something if Hades down too, or whatever. If they want to find a way, they'll do it. But it seems like with All-Stars having just happened, that well is probably dry for the near future. So they're going to have a few more years to wait. But if and when there is another season with returning players, do you think that George can adapt? I guess unless he's hitting the gym right now, physically, he's still going to be pretty behind the mark. But in terms of the social chops, where if he doesn't get off to such a unique and bad start, could he turn that part of it around, do you think?
Well, first of all, aren't they bringing people back next season for Blood versus Water?
Wait, they are?
Yes, I believe February is a February, I believe, is a Blood versus Water season that's half returnees, half new players.
It's airing in February?
I think so.
Okay, well, I take back what I said about maybe not having to wait so long then. Do we have any suspected or confirmed names there, do you know?
I have no idea. I just saw the one article. I think it was an Inside Survivor article that said it was going to be half returnees for a Blood versus Water season, which I am very excited about because I love a good Blood versus Water season.
Yeah, I think if you're going to do the half and half kind of thing, that is the way to do it, as opposed to fans versus favorites or even like champions versus contenders, where it feels right. Like half of the people at least are just being set up to fail from the get-go.
I agree. But with George specifically, hopefully George is not on this very next season because I think he probably will benefit from a little more time off. But I do think if George actually goes back and watches the tape and sees kind of exactly what he was doing wrong in the beginning. And listen, he is all over the edit, so he's going to get a lot of game tape to watch to see exactly what was pissing people off and to watch what was not landing in his final tribal council speech. Because it seemed like when he got the final tribal, he had like kind of already decided. He was like, I'm not going to apologize for anything. I'm just going to repeat the same five things over and over again. I'm going to compliment people on their questions, but not actually answer them. So I think with if he can actually reflect on what went wrong and kind of show some humility and watch it back, I think he definitely can improve, as long as he's not just like such a big threat that people like feel the need to target him right away.
Yeah, you saw some of those signs of the worst of what people associate with being a political operative, right? It's mm-hmm. the thank you for your question, that's such a great exactly. question, the kind of clumsy buttering people up in a way which they don't even appreciate. It's very Albertian, I guess, in that sense.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly. Yes, he was. You could tell he was a politician in those final tribals.
Absolutely. I guess, well, he's not even a politician, right? He's a SPAD or something. He's a political operative. I don't know if George ran for office himself, how well that would turn out.
I'd love to see it.
Honestly, that is a well I'm surprised they don't tap into more often, is finding like actual... Maybe it would have to be retired politicians. I don't know if any serving MPs or whatever would be able to or want to go on the show. But in terms of occupations which should, in theory, be the perfect setup for a show like Survivor, for better or for worse, you know, politician is up there with undercover cop or some of the ones that we see succeed all the time here.
Yeah, that's true. They should be going to that well a little more often.
Yeah, and I'm sure if Haley runs the public office, you'll be the first one on the plane to work on the campaign there. And so maybe
whatever she needs me for, I'm there.
Of course. Anyone who maybe you're not quite that devoted to, but any just random favorites who maybe didn't get the dozens and dozens of confessionals that the two leading lights got here?
I like I said, I really love Baden just because of his role of helping Haley. Anyone who was working with Haley, I love them in the moment. But before, you know, a long time ago, before I was even a Haley stan at all, I was rooting for the three Braun women of Shannon, Flick, and Kez. I think your name was Kez, right?
Maddie. Her name was Kez. I have a soft spot for Kez, who, you know, tragically gone too soon. Yes. You know, a victim of other things in the game. But I really wish Kez had made it to that jury, if only for her facial expressions, because she always
she was something else with this.
Always has some very vivid reactions to things.
No, yeah, I thought that they were going to be the three women running the game, but Shannon, of course, who tragically lost way too soon. She didn't even make the merge. Shannon was the one I was really rooting for, because it looked like she was going to be in trouble for the first couple of votes, and then when she survived those, I was like, oh my god, this queen, she's going to make it all the way. But we lost her. We we lose Kez at the merge, and then we get Flick the whole season, but she definitely didn't dominate in the way that I thought she was going to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, any lessons that you think other versions of Survivor could learn from the Australian one, or vice versa, other than, I guess, get Haley a US visa so you get to enjoy her there too?
Oh God, imagine. I mean, I just think the important thing is give us an end game back, which is the thing I like the most. Stop fast-forwarding the most interesting part of the game. And also, I think the pre-merge as well. Like, obviously, Australian Survivor is able to do this because they have so many people, but they start with two tribes of 12, which is a lot better than starting, like, with three tribes of six. Like, I don't like the aspect of, like, not having anywhere to hide, and you just get, like, a group of four together, and you could kind of, like, run the pre-merge. With the way it's set up in Australian Survivor, it's like you kind of have two merge tribes, like the size of two merge tribes, just going at it in the pre-merge. And then on top of that, they usually only swap, like, once. So we really get to, like, see tribe dynamics play out for, like, eight straight episodes before they even swap. And that's another thing which I don't love in the U.S., where they seem to be doing, like, you know, two or three swaps before the merge these days, which just gets too much. It's too confusing. You don't know who's voting with who and why they're voting with who. So that's just another thing they could take from Australian Survivor. And just, I don't know, just make me care more, like Australian Survivor does.
It did seem like the season dragged for a bit, where especially when the former Braun women, like Rachel and so on, and Georgia, it seemed like they were just going to get picked off. Yeah. But that did also give time for this prolonged grudge and resentment to really, like, simmer and develop and play out. And it feels like some of those longer term storylines just never get a chance to breathe, especially on US Survivor. And I would say more of that is just 25 longer episodes versus, you know, 14 shorter ones. It's hard to mm-hmm. to not do that when you have that much time yeah. to play with. But if you can find a way to distill that down just enough and hit that sweet spot, then I think that's a really key thing to tap into, because it feels like, especially some of the seasons, even the more popular ones in the 30s, but also the less popular ones, right? Like the Island of the Idols and so on. You just had no idea why things were happening. It was exactly, like, okay, yeah. Well, I guess it's a blindside that this person got voted out, but that's more because you just literally can't follow what's going on, as opposed to you have assumptions in place because you know, you think you know these people, and then one of them comes up with some new idea.
Yeah, and other people have said this, but it's pretty much like live action Brent Seals at this point, where some people are just like, they're just coming, voting blocks are just coming together, they're voting out. Am I supposed to care about people turning on other people when I didn't even know they were working together to begin with? Or like, why should I care who you're voting out when I don't even know why you're voting them out? Like, it has gotten to the point where I just don't even really like pay attention to who voted out who. I'm just like, oh, okay, this person was voted out. So like, less hikes up the mountain, less tribe swaps and advantages, and really let these things, like, give us two tribes of nine to start out and let those play out for a little bit, and do like one tribe swap at most. And I think we'll have plenty of time to go over why I'm supposed to care about these people and why they're voting the way that they are.
Mm-hmm. And with that, any more general hot takes or lukewarm takes to dispense it while you have this platform on Survivor Australia, Australian Survivor, or anything else that takes your fancy?
I think Jonathan LaPaglia is the best host in the game.
Hard agree. Yeah. I love Nico as well. I don't know. I guess you would have to be more into Survivor South Africa to develop that soft spot yeah. for Nico. But honestly, I would say, where does Matt Chisholm fall into this ranking for you?
He doesn't. I've forgotten all about Matt Chisholm.
Which is honestly inevitable, given that Survivor New Zealand is off the air, but also a yeah. sign of, you know, that franchise in general, and maybe why it has not returned to our screens. But yeah, of the big three, I suppose, Jeff Probst, JLP, and Nico, I think Jeff is very good at some of the things that he does, but now that he is just the ruler of all he surveys, and he gets to manifest whatever he wants on a Survivor season, I feel like having that distance is something I really appreciate even more now about the Nikos and the JLPs of the world, even beyond just like their sheer hosting ability.
Yeah, I used to love Jeff and think he was a great host, but I'm just so over him at this point. He's become like a caricature of himself, and he doesn't know what makes the show good anymore and doesn't know what good TV is. So I'm over him. And then we have JLP just being, you know, hilarious and handsome and charming, and seems like he actually like cares about the contestants too. And he's on Twitter making jokes, like he's got it all, really.
Yeah, we want good TV. That is what we want. And JLP, I think, knows how to provide that at this point.
Couldn't have said it any better myself.
I mean, maybe he doesn't. Maybe if we actually got a look into the mind of JLP, we would discover that you know, he is just the host for a reason, and God forbid he ever get his hands on the reins himself creatively someday. But for now, I am perfectly happy just to ignore that question entirely and enjoy him just guiding a group of Australians through tribal council.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. He seems like on Twitter, like when some of these dumber twists kind of happen, he seems to kind of like make fun of them along with people on Twitter. So I think he has a good mind for this stuff. But, you know, maybe if the power got to his head, he'd lose control like Probst did.
Which Australian celebrities do you think would have the worst impact if their voices here were being listened to?
I'll have to brush up on my Australian celebrities to answer that one.
Yeah, I feel like maybe this is just a sign of how completely dominant American culture is, but I feel like I couldn't name an Australian celebrity. And if I, maybe I know of some, but I just wrongly assume they're American for like that exact same reason.
Yeah, Nicole Kidman, she's Australian.
Okay.
I think she'll have to get into JLP's ears and give him some advice.
Yeah. Maybe you never know. Maybe she got into Survivor during quarantine, just binging it all on Netflix as everyone else did these days.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if she's a big fan, but she might as well be.
Yeah, well, I don't know if we can find Nicole Kidman on Twitter to chat Survivor, but if people want to be finding you and if you want to be found, where should they be hitting you up?
Follow me on Twitter at MattyFresh24. It's the only social media I use, so at MattyFresh24.
Any hashtags that people should be muting before they do that?
Oh God, what's even on these days?
I guess BB23 just ended, so we're safe from that for another, you know, 8 months or so.
And if you're listening to this, you probably like Survivor, so you don't have to mute the Survivor hashtag.
Do you? So I feel like the most times I've been spoiled on Australian Survivor or South African Survivor over the past few years is just logging on and people who actually live in those countries or are watching live are talking about it. No hashtag, no spoiler warning, nothing. It's just out there for the world, which they owe me nothing. I don't think they should have to hide their tweets or hide their views or whatever, but maybe I need to be more vigilant about who I follow or something. But it does feel like it's always like a tripwire where I don't know when these shows are airing live, and I just log on to Twitter for the 16th time that day and just get spoiled on, you know, the episode that I was looking forward to watching whenever it aired.
Yeah, I got spoiled a lot. Like, I would say I was spoiled in some capacity, like one out of every two or three episodes. Like, once a week, I was pretty much getting spoiled on something that was happening, whether it be who actually got voted out or, like, a big twist that was happening. And, I don't know. It didn't really bother me. Like, I'm not someone who seeks out spoilers, but if I do get spoiled, I'll still enjoy the show, even knowing who gets booted. So, you know, the Australians can do what they want and not have to worry about me.
Yeah, it might be a sign of not the lack of esteem, but just how much more I care, maybe incorrectly, about the US version, that if someone spoils me on Survivor SA or Survivor Australia, I'll be annoyed, but I won't care too much. Whereas if someone spoiled me on even just the next week for American Survivor, I would just be fuming. You know, I would have to log off for the sake of self-control.
Yeah, true. I expect to get spoiled on Australian Survivor. I would never expect anyone to spoil me on American Survivor.
You deserve to be spoiled in the good way, Matt, not the bad way.
Thank you for saying that. I agree.
Yeah, well, if you do want to spoil Matt on Twitter, then you know where to find him. You can find me on Twitter for whatever purpose you like, really, at DomHRV. And that will do it for Australian Survivor coverage for the next few months, at least, until February. And hopefully we'll be back with maybe some wrap-ups for BB23, Survivor South Africa, and, of course, the weekly US Survivor coverage every week for as long as that remains tolerable, which, you know, getting off to a good start now. Hopefully that does not age badly either. But until then, we'll talk to all of you again soon. Take care, everybody.